Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to Laura Fox for entertaining us this afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of March, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Chelsea could be changing hands. We are joined by football journalist David Sinead with the latest. We'll preview the Women's National League with Shauna Cook and Kylie Murphy, and also catch up with new Sligo Rovers boss Steve Feeney. We'll also talk camogie with Aoife Murray and ladies football with Nadine Doherty. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. I am delighted to say that David Sinead, football journalist, is with me live in studio, as is Nadine Doherty, former Donegal Gaelic footballer. We're going to start with you, David, and the situation with Chelsea. It does seem like it's escalated pretty quickly. There was a lot of speculation earlier in the week that Roman Abramovich was going to sell it. It seems now he's pretty ready to sell it, with a lot of reports suggesting that bids should be on the table by Friday.
I know. It seems kind of almost not pointless, but just kind of almost futile talking about the nature of a billionaire having to sell a football club when you think of the reason why it actually has to happen. And like, how often over the last, I don't know, number of weeks, months, in terms of coming in chatting football with yourself, and maybe you started with the Newcastle takeover, and just shows you how modern football and the ties that are there with these different elements of what's happening. And for people who love football and love the game, it's just so sad. Like, I was reading the details of what's happening. It's like, there's a Hans-Jörg Weiss, the Swiss billionaire, kind of obviously talking about the fact that Abramovich clearly wants the quick sale, and the reason being is because the quicker it's sold means the money will stay in his hands, because if it doesn't, then obviously the UK government, who are going to be imposing sanctions possibly on kind of oligarchs in who are based in England, it's a way of keeping the money in his hands, really. He's already passed on the stewardship and care of the football of Chelsea to the foundation, just as a way previously of trying to almost protect his position. And you think of what's happening now, even just before we came on there, you listen to news and you're talking about Kharkiv, a city who everyone will know because of football and the European Championships, and this, like, Poland, Ukraine just held that in 2012. And like, called a special place in my heart, even though Ireland didn't play there, just because it was like the first championship I got to cover as a journalist, and Ireland were there. And you listen and you kind of have a link to these places a little bit, and you see on TV what's happening, and it's like heartbreaking. Really is heartbreaking. And we're here discussing now, well, Abramovich wants to sell this football club to make sure he can keep a couple of extra billion, and you see what's happened with Chelsea and like football, the nature of football. And it's almost not that there's a poignancy to it, but you look at the kind of the growth and what's happened in the Premier League, and for a lot of people, I think Chelsea would epitomise what's wrong with football and modern football. His takeover back in, just was it 2003, I think it was 2003, 2004, I think he got them for £1, because Chelsea were in such a state under Ken Bates before that. They had just beaten Liverpool. It's mad how it was just like they had just beaten Liverpool to qualify for the Champions League, and if they hadn't won that game, like, Abramovich wouldn't have had any interest in Chelsea, because there was no point. And then the whole, he has not single-handedly but played a major factor in changing the shape of English football, like Chelsea, the success that they've had over the last number of years, the managers they've had,
and the, like, access to the money, of course,
and the access
as well,
to the money, yeah. And then you see this, right, and this is where the, like, anger does come into it a little bit. You see how quickly people can say, well, this isn't right, what's happening. We know, like, everyone has known for so long of the links Abramovich has had with Putin, clearly the governments, and you see the money that's happening in the UK and all the rest of it, and yet it's taken a country to be invaded for something like this to happen. And yet, and we're all guilty of it, you know, as well. You almost don't want to. You don't want to know about it sometimes. And as far as a football journalist, you're covering, you're like, well, now you do. You have to be aware of these things properly. Like, not that you don't be aware of world events, clearly, but like, you can't ignore it anymore with what's happening in sport. And like, there's a sadness to it. Like, there really is not. There's a sadness to it because there's now people dying, and now we're talking about, oh, well, Chelsea, oh, what's going to happen with Chelsea? Are they going to have a new owner? You know what I mean? And like, it's far more bigger aspects to this, really much more bigger aspects to this, and Abramovich that hopefully will soon be resolved, but I don't know what's going to happen. Like.
Yeah, and David, what you're saying there about, you know, we ignore it and the fans ignore it, journalists ignore it, when FIFA and UEFA are ignoring it, the FA, the higher echelons of football you know.
Well, and even when you look at what's happened, in fairness, I think UEFA more so than FIFA have kind of acted a bit swiftly in terms of what they did last week. It took FIFA, like FIFA kind of said, "What we're not going to include, we can't call them Russia if you're playing." Like, where that's what you did if you're kind of doping a little bit.
Following the Olympic.
Yeah, whereas this is like a war. Like, this is an invasion of a country, and like it took FIFA then to actually realize, well, this isn't going to happen. I know we were chatting, Marie, before about, you look at what has happened in football in the UK in the Premier League, and for all the faults that are there, and there were a lot, but like there's been a lot of kind of maybe progress in terms of the social justice. They talk about like the Black Lives Matter movement and bringing that to the forefront. You see what Marcus Rashford has done, and literally taking on the British government to help feed children, and that's brilliant and it's great. And you see some of the stuff that's going to be happening at the weekend. I think captains are going to be having the Ukrainian flag as the captain's armband, and there's going to be a moment of reflection, and that's all brilliant. It's fantastic. But the bigger point here is it's totally away from football. It's making sure that what's happening in the Ukraine and what's happening with Russia, like how does that get resolved? And you just hope maybe if stuff, the sanctions and your stuff, what's happening with, say, Abramovich, if somehow Anton can come of a true sport, and what's happening with people, like stuff that, I don't know, like the sanctions that are happening and the kind of consequences that can be happening through sport, you like to think that if that does somehow have any good, hopefully that's the only way you can hope. It could be a small bit of good, but provided it can be some good amount of it. But
I think
it just feels how weak and pointless.
You have that little bit of hope, and then the headlines come in, and it's like, well, two footballers have just been killed there in bombings, and an international skier as well. So it does feel like it's futile, really, because it just seems that it's almost untouchable, that Putin and what he's doing is just so far removed from maybe what we're interested in and what we're connected to, which is sport and the voices of sport. He doesn't care about that sort of stuff. He is just on a completely different level and playing field, and it's not even on his radar.
And like you see some of the clips over the last little while of, say, Infantino with Putin with the World Cup. Like, this is the thing.
They're mired in it.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And like, you see, and then again, it comes back, and you kind of look at myself, and you're kind of thinking, like, you just want to ignore it. You don't want to, unless it's there in your face, you don't want to know about some of the bad stuff that's going on in the world sometimes. You want to just live your life and you want to enjoy sport. And like, I don't think it's a bad thing to be able to say that. Like, you want the sport, for a lot of people, is your release from the grind of life.
Distraction from reality.
Yeah, exactly. But you see this, and like, not to make it a bit personal, so like, say, a cousin of mine is home from Australia, first time I've seen him in 4 years, and we were driving around Luke, and today where we woke up and we're talking about, like, just growing up playing football together, and these little, like, we're literally going past different greens and all, and you're talking about players who we love growing up, like Lubo Moravcik at Celtic and all, right? Brilliant. It was just gas, hilarious.
That's him texting you now, isn't it?
I know, yeah. But then look what you're saying there about the two Ukrainian footballers, and then you get that flash up on your phone and you're having this discussion about it, and it just totally takes you away from why you do love sport. And even say Dundalk in one of the when Dundalk played in St. Petersburg 2016 in the Europa League, like, St. Petersburg is one of the loveliest cities that I've ever been in my life. Like, I would have loved to have gone back there. I felt so lucky and fortunate to have been there, and the people, and I'll be honest, right, like, I was going on over there that's 2016. I was going over there as a 28-year-old, and you kind of have this view of what Russia is like. Mm. But beyond that, what's happened with Putin, like, there's people there, some of the friendliest people and the nicest people who have ever encountered, and was there, managed to have a few days there, and you got to actually properly see a city rather than just going in and out and covering the game. And that's a sadness as well, because like, these people now are almost going to get tired with it, and like, to be Russian soldiers who, they don't want to be there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's,
I think,
it's heartbreaking, really is.
Yeah, when you hear as well the likes of Andriy Shevchenko coming out on Sky Sports News and just shining a light really on what the reality is like for his family at home, that you realise how perilous the situation is. Actually, we have the clip of him here. He was speaking on Sky Sports News just a little while ago.
First of all, I want to thank you, my nation, army, President Vladimir Zelensky, to do everything possible to defend my country from Russian aggression. And then I'm so proud to be Ukrainian. And then it's a very difficult moment for my country, for my people, for my family. My mom and my sister is in Kyiv this moment, and it's terrible things happen there. It's people dying, children dying, missiles pointing in our houses. And we need to stop this war. We need to find a way to stop the war.
It's absolutely heartbreaking, this David. And like a former Chelsea player, and at the top of the show, we're talking about him, Abramovich trying to sell Chelsea just so he can keep his millions in his pockets. And then on the other hand, you have a former player of the club who's talking about keeping his family alive.
I know. And then even that link, like, you think, I saw that clip earlier, like, he just seems broken, doesn't he? Like, that, like, yeah. You hear it in his voice, and you think of Shevchenko, the player, and it's just like all action, powerful, just a sensational player. Part of the reason, again, it was actually not that funny at all, but like when Abramovich signed him and Michael Ballack together, it was like he was the player he wanted, mm-hmm. he coveted more than anyone else, and he kind of gets, he's just being used, do you know what I mean? Like, obviously all footballers probably feel that at some point in their career, but like listening to that, and it's just it comes back to what I was saying earlier about how can anyone in sport, or how can something to do with sport make any kind of a difference. Like, the reason why he's doing that is because he knows the profile of himself,
his platform,
platform he has, and going out on that and kind of bringing it through to people. Because like, there's a sense here as well where you'd like to think not, but like with football clubs and any football club, but like they get tribal a little bit, you know what I mean? So I know Chelsea are going to be, I know they played obviously the cup final of the weekend and got beat, and then like fans can almost get a bit protective over their own club. Some, it's a weird kind of thing, and it's just how we all are wired.
Misguided loyalties,
You always have that little kind of little party, and but like I'd say a lot of Chelsea fans that would resonate with them. Not that I don't think that they needed it, but even for just general sports fans to see Shevchenko come out and talking about it, and just because you do, you kind of maybe have that link, and you can kind of maybe get a greater understanding, but it kind of can maybe emotionally attach to you a bit more if you see someone who you've maybe grown up loving as a player.
So even the Klitschkos, the boxers going out, and you know that they're on the front line, and also then Alexander Usyk, the boxer too, seeing him not having any fear whatsoever, and just showing the importance of what it means to him and why he has to join the military to defend his own country. It's just quite surreal, really, because these are people obviously that we have grown up watching in the ring and on the football pitches, and to hear them actually talk about that reality that they're going through. And just as you said, David, as well, like, you know, like we're going to tune in tonight and probably watch Chelsea and Luton or Liverpool and Norwich tonight and Southampton and West Ham in the FA Cup, and probably not think about it again. You know, it's really, really strange situation to be in.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask David there, you know, talking about supporters and you have the tribal. Do you see Chelsea supporters going against Abramovich? Like, do you see protests happening?
Well, do you know what, right? And I wasn't expecting this. When the Super League was happening, the Chelsea fans were some of the first out there in terms of, you saw the protests outside Stamford Bridge. They were the ones who mobilised probably quickest out of hand. And like a lot of stuff gets thrown at Chelsea fans in terms of, oh, do you know what, a lot of fans when he came after Abramovich or whatever, but it's not really the case. Like, people always say, oh, the Chelsea, there's that song fans sing about you haven't got history or whatever. Well, they have. They've got over, like, they were formed in like 1905. It's mad. They've actually got really strong links to Ireland going back years. Like, Vincent, I remember doing a piece, James Kirwan, back in like the early 1900s, who went over and played for Chelsea, and he was one of their first signings in Stamford Bridge and stuff. Like, they've got an amazing history. Might not have always been successful, and that has come maybe more so with Ramage, but yeah, with Chelsea, man, like I was more so saying that with Detroit, but just because maybe it's something different, and it's a bit different when you see the seriousness of what's happened. I think a lot of people should put all that to one side and know the difference with what's going on there and stuff. But yeah, like Chelsea fans, in terms of within the Super League stuff was happening, they were some of the first to mobilise, and a lot of people kind of actually went on that back. They kind of realised, well, actually, if a club like, if a fan base like Chelsea, who maybe have benefited a lot from
the super club
nature of it, can realise, well, this is wrong. So I don't think you'd be seeing like Russian flags at Stamford Bridge and some of that.
I meant the opposite way. You know, will they turn against Abramovich. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think as well, like the fact that he's going to be selling the club, isn't he? Like, it's going to happen. It looks as if it's like the Swiss billionaire who was saying that, and he's backed by even by a few Americans who could be involved. And then typical, you hear them talking about it. Well, the price is too much, you know. And straight away, you're like straight back into the capitalist nature of it. Like, you'll have those billionaires there, and they're billionaires for a reason, because they'd be wanting to. They'd be saying, well, Abramovich is weaker, you know.
They'll exploit the situation in a big way,
which is not a bad thing, I suppose, as well. If they hit it, but like again, it just shows you where that's what it's like.
It's business,
transactional.
It's all money. Yeah. It's all transactional, and that, even with what's going on in Ukraine, it all comes down to money.
Yeah,
and that's the unfortunate.
Everton, just speaking of money, have suspended all commercial and sponsorship activities with Russian companies. So they had associations with USM, Megaphone, and Yotta, and they are going to remove signage of all three companies in the move.
That's
which
a big
is,
one, because USM, they sponsor Everton's training ground, Finch Farm. And I was at Usmanov, who was had links with Arsenal as well. I know obviously Everton now are pretty much in sole control of Fahir Masharidi, but again, it comes back to like, these are little big things in our realm of sport. You know, I know United did it with Aeroflot, didn't they? They're kind of like the Russian backed and airline who would have sponsored United. And even again, coming back to UEFA, and like sometimes you do have to praise them, but very quickly they got rid of Gazprom, and they're like UEFA's biggest sponsor. 34 million they give them every year to sponsor the Champions League. So it's, I think with sport that it probably maybe is coming out, it's those little big things that maybe could make a small bit of a difference possibly, and then you're just hoping the grown-ups and what's actually happening with people.
Yeah, well, they're all small things, and when they come together, hopefully you would think that maybe they're become a big thing. I saw FIFA have taken Russia out of the video game, so that's another little thing as well. Okay, well, we're going to talk about the FA Cup games, but we might do that a little bit later on. We're going to take a very quick break now, and then it's into the Women's National League.
RTE 2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It is now time to talk women's Gaelic games, and we're going to start with Camogie. I am delighted to say that Aoife Murray is with us now on the line. Aoife, it is a very busy weekend for Camogie. It is the All-Ireland Club Finals weekend, and I think that the game between Oulartabala and Sarsfields has the makings of being an absolute cracker.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, they've been the two best teams probably over the last 3 to 4 years. You know, obviously it's a very close game there before in December. I think it's got the makings of a cracking game. I hope Ray lets the game go. Was I suppose what goes in favour of Sarsfields really, I think, might be the open pitch. Croke Park is quite a big field, and I just wonder will they have any a little bit more in the legs than Ireland. But listen, I don't think I've ever written off the likes of Una Lacy before, and I won't do it now. So it should be a cracking game.
Yeah, it should, and I think there's probably a lot been made of the age profile of Oulart because of the likes of Ursula Jacob and Una Lacy, but at the same time they do have players like the Kyos who have unbelievable legs and they never stop going, so there is a bit of a good balance there.
Yeah, I think they've got a great mix, and look, you know what maybe some of the girls might be on the wrong side of 30, what they have at regards to Camogie intelligence, I don't think you can replicate that. So having that nice blend of, you know, younger, extreme speedsters in the Kyos, and then having that Camogie intelligence, I think it's a super mix.
Yeah, it really is. Croke Park, though, as you said, like big, wide open spaces. Sarsfields, they didn't really get the rub of the green in the last final. And they do have those kind of younger players that seem to have the legs anyway and are a little bit lighter, I guess, because, you know, some of them are quite young and Croke Park probably will suit them. But coming back after a loss like that and losing All Ireland and final, how difficult will it be to get the confidence going again? And I suppose, look, the manner that they lost it in as well, Oulart got off to such a good start. It was really difficult to contain them. Do you think they're going to be able to bounce back from that in such a short space of time?
I absolutely do. Look, they had a great a real tough semi-final, so it was a great win for them to come over Shlock Neil. I think they obviously had the harder as well of the two semi-finals. The beauty is you've got a lot of those girls in the Sarsfields team. You know, the last time they were in Crow Park, they won the All-Ireland. And I think, look, the game only 2 months ago, look, I'd be very disappointed if they weren't able to bounce back. And knowing some of the characters that are there, I would say that they cannot wait for Sunday to come around.
Yeah, they're definitely a determined group. And when you think that about Owlert and the last few months, they seem to just have camogie and weddings because there was so much of it going on. But in a way, like, I think that isn't a bad thing because you're not as maybe caught up in the day-to-day, the camogie and being so obsessed with it because there's so much else going on and so many other kind of life things, and there's a few of them with kids and things like that as well. And obviously Stacey had got married, and then Stacey Keogh, and then Ursula got married, Ursula Jacob, and I think Shelley Keogh's getting married very soon as well. So they're flat out.
Yeah, but look, I suppose for me, club always has been to, I suppose, reflect life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great show maybe to younger girls and parents out there that we can balance both, and actually having both, you know, whether it's big life events like getting married or passing exams or starting a new job, to going out and playing a game you love, I think it reflects a really good balance. And I think it's a great it's great promotion for women in sport. And it hasn't stopped any of these. It hasn't stopped showing them their talent. Mm-hmm. It hasn't stopped them living their life as well. And look, we always used to put things on in the winter thinking we might get away with it with camogie. But I think what they're doing, they're an absolute super example to why women should stay in sport.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And like, even hearing about Una Lacey and Ursula, and just the fact that they're managing them so well, so there's not this massive pressure on them to be at every session doing the same as the 19-year-olds, that there's a place for everybody, and they don't have to have that level of physical commitment that they, you know, you'd associate with playing an All-Ireland final, that they're being managed in a way that suits them from a load point of view. And then they're obviously going out performing unbelievably as well. So like, it does make you think that, okay, you don't have to be 25 in the peak of your fitness to go out and be contesting, not only contesting, but be influencing All-Ireland finals as well.
Yeah, I think maybe it's a good example to coaches, and particularly young coaches out there, who try to, and look, I know from my own side of it, growing a little bit older, you know, working longer hours, it is hard to do the same as somebody that maybe is 10, 15 years younger than you. But when you do have a coach and a manager who actually treats you like a person, look, we always say, you know, there is a person behind that player, or there's a player behind that person. And I think they're obviously really seeing the person or putting the person first, Marie. And I think for, you know, and maybe that's why they're still playing the game, that they can have that balance. And look, you know, Una Lacey only ever wins at Una Lacey's pace, so no better woman, and she'd trick you very, very quickly. So look, I think it's a great example, and maybe more coaches out there should be maybe taking a leaf out of their book.
Yeah, for sure. Look, we do know as well, though, Intercounty, you know, it is a little bit more full on, and, you know, there's so much of it at the moment, and there's so much commitment needed to it. There was a few good games at the weekend, and for your own Cork, pretty easy win over Limerick, and probably needed to go about their business kind of without having any drama, I'd say, as well, Aoife.
Yeah, look, it's from the get-go, what was it, within 5 minutes, it was 1-3 to no score. And in fairness, you know, if you just look at the score and you go 5-17 to 6 points, you know, God, you dive straight into, I suppose, the negatives for Limerick. They were missing two of their best players, I think, in Caoimhe Costello and Michelle Delay. So I think you have to take that into account. However, look, I think we always say, isn't it, men versus boys, reason. There's always those sayings out there. And it's not very popular of me to say it, but it was, for me, a case of women versus girls. Mm-hmm. The physical conditioning and fitness of the Cork panel versus that of the Limerick, and I know Limerick are a young team, but they were poles apart, and I would just have concerns going into the championship. It's not something that you can fix in a couple of months. I hope there is a long-term plan there for Limerick, because one sure thing is they certainly don't lack that the natural basics of the game, which are something you can't really teach at this level. So for me, there was such a gulf between that physical conditioning, like Cork were just shrugging them off, Even the style of play, I think it got to the stage where Limerick were just getting the ball and hitting it as far as they could, only for it to be played quite smartly back down and having one-to-one situations inside.
Yeah, like, we're in March now. The championship's going to come around pretty quickly. Are you a little bit concerned? I think maybe, like, Dublin obviously made easy work of Offaly as well, and you kind of hoped that Offaly would maybe build on the little bit of momentum that they'd that they had built up over last season, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems there's you know, maybe all isn't well there at the moment. A lot of work needs to be done, but is the gap there between, not even the we'll say if there's four or five at the top, between, is the middle group even moving further from the top group that we talk about, the Galways and the Corks and the Kilkennys and the Tips, Waterfords and Clare, maybe around the middle?
Maybe I'm being biased, I would always still have Cork, Kilkenny and Galway at the top tier. And I still think Waterford have a good distance to go, and I am concerned that they haven't managed to break that, I suppose, quarter final, get that duck off their back yet. And I don't know, have they done enough work on that physical side to do it? And I just feel that gap is widening, which is really disappointing, because I think it's something that you could have foreseen 5-6 years ago. Certainly towards the latter end of my days, it was something that I noticed quite a lot playing teams, in particularly teams the likes of Waterford, where, you know, they would really be with us for, you know, 45 minutes of that game, 50 minutes, and the last 10 to 15 minutes we would find another gear, but they just couldn't get it. And for me, that wasn't changing for the last few years of when I was playing, and it hasn't necessarily changed. So I would have a concern that those top three teams are pushing further and further away. Now, you can easily come back to me and say, listen, Kilkenny only beat Clare by a point. But I would still say Kilkenny are the strangest team in the league. They always kind of maybe stuttered their way through it and end up winning it.
Yeah.
So I don't think I can say too much there. But I would have concerns, but it's been signposted for a number of years now for county boards to really invest in that side of the game.
Do you think that's what it is? So, like, I think from the outside looking in for the last number of years, you could see there was a gap there, and probably if you were a little bit experienced in inter-county setups, you would know what needs to be done to close that gap in terms of investing and supporting. Is it that these counties haven't been supported in the right way in order to be able to push on, or is it a case that while these counties were being supported, so were the top three and they've pushed on even further?
Yeah, and I think maybe, and when I say investing, I don't necessarily mean financial investments. Mm-hmm. I can only use my own experience on this. I remember 2012, Mary, where, honestly, we could not do a squat, right?
Yeah.
We were in really bad state. We had a really bad 2011. And it took us, I suppose, 3 years to get back up to winning in All-Ireland? And it literally took us that amount of time. And it wasn't necessarily any financial investments, but I suppose what the management team did, along with the county board, they invested in good coaches. Yeah. And we started early enough in the year to do all those basics so that when the weather got better, we could just really concentrate on hurling, and hurling being the core to our training sessions. And that's what I mean by investing. I do wonder sometimes, and I'd often look at backroom teams to see who's doing the S&C and the hurling coaching, etc. And I suppose that is one concern that maybe that hasn't been invested enough in some of these teams over the last number of years.
Yeah, and we're going to move on to integration, and I don't think that integration is going to solve that, unfortunately, but I do still think that it is important and an important step that needs to be taken. Nadine Doherty is with us as well. And Nadine, this week, Helen O'Rourke, the CEO of Ladies Football, has come out and with her annual review and shone a bit of a light on her thinking on the integration. And I found it quite interesting saying that she rejected the public perception that the association does not want a merger, because a lot of time that was what was bandied about, that, look, it's not going to happen because Ladies Football don't want it. She's saying here now that she's okay with it, but it's going to take time.
Yeah, and I'm glad Helen has come out and spoken out. Obviously not directly to the media, it's through her annual report. But even her commenting on Liam O'Neill's comments a number of years ago, you know, it was good to hear that. But I suppose what Helen said, this has gone back to 2014. And back then she said this is a process that might take up to 10 years. We've 2 years here to go.
Yeah, we're already at that. Yeah.
So, and I did say way back a few weeks ago, I was like, I don't see this happening for another two or three years. And I don't. But what I do know and feel has happened, three associations have probably already sat down. I feel they meet on a weekly, if not monthly basis anyway. We don't know, but I'm presuming. They'll have further discussions. And I think at this point, perhaps Jack Chambers, Minister for Sport, might come to the table. I do think a bit of political will is going to come into this. But it is good. It's great for Helen to come out and say that. And she's saying something that deep down we all know. But I think what's key to this, and she hasn't said, it's going to be on their terms. And I've written about it, I've spoken about it. I think the LGFA have the most to lose, but I also feel that they probably have the most power when it comes to demands and so on. And if I wanted anybody fighting my corner, it would be Helen O'Rourke. You know, there's been a lot of anecdotes in the media this week about, let's see, there was like clubs around the country that already have integration happening, but the women are still being treated as second best. Come out and name the clubs.
Yeah.
Like this is no more than what Conor Myler said there 2 weeks ago. If you're staying quiet, you're part of the problem. So don't come out and give the anecdotes. Come out and say, well, it was this club and this club, and call the people out. Another thing that Helen and other people have talked about, that amalgamation won't solve the pitch problem. We all know that. Mm-hmm. But if that is a problem, that's your number one demand. Fixtures, make that your number one demand, be it just Camogie and Ladies Football, who sort their master fixture plans side by side. Like, the things that keep coming up, make them your demands, and whatever it is you want, go in with those at the top of your list, and then perhaps it might take less time.
Aoife, with your Camogie hat and your Gaelic players hat on as well, are you confident that there is going to be progress on this?
I absolutely do. Looking at the Congress at the weekend, I think, listen, 90%, the voice couldn't have been louder, really. Having the Camogie Association to weigh in behind that as well with their own motion. And I really like some of the elements of their motion, in particularly on the whole, you know, regular updates, because I think that's what's happened. There's been that void of information and communication, hasn't there? And I think we've all been let read between the lines. I read Helen's piece quite interestingly, because it seemed like she was fighting back a certain amount of the things that had been in the media, whereas I feel like the GAA and the Camogie have kind of stepped up in a real positive and open manner. I do agree with her with regard to it being proper, open-minded process. Absolutely. But, you know, it's interesting to hear Nadine say that LGFA have the most to lose. Is it LGFA top brass had the most to lose, or is it the players had most to lose? And I think there's a disconnect between those that sit at the top table and the players who are actually playing the game. And I think anybody who thinks that this is a silver bullet, that we join and we can do it in a very short time, we are absolutely calling ourselves. There's going to be a process, but I think the players have called for an open process where they can be a part of, and they can understand how long it's going to take, what are the steps, what are the milestones, and what are the metrics that we can actually go and test it against to see are we on track to achieve the goals. And like any process or any merger, there has to be compromise. Of course you go in with your list of demands and your expectations, but there has to be compromise. And if one out of the three are not willing to compromise, then that's to the detriment of the game and the player's experience. And at the end of the day, we have to put the player's experience first.
Yeah, even myself and yourself spoke about that disconnect last week, and I think a big turning point for that, or when that really peaked, was, you know, the Cork Galway game being moved to Croke Park, and, you know, we won't go over it again, but the fallout after that. But what I felt happened around that time, the players felt that those who should be advocating for them, they nearly hung them out to dry. You know, there were a couple of media appearances. There was a lack of media appearances from the higher end of the LGFA. So that was one part of the disconnect. But I also feel, you know, the new generation of players, and I'm absolutely not having a go at any of them here. I back them 100%. But 25 years ago, they, you know, don't know what it was like then. And they probably don't have a huge or massive insight into the work that has gone on by the LGFA. And what they're doing is absolutely correct, 100%. But perhaps they're maybe not aware of the huge autonomy built in that time and that essentially could be lost. So I think there is a bit of a mix of what the LGFA as an association themselves feel they could lose. And perhaps for younger players, they don't feel there's anything to lose. You know, and I'm not taking sides here at all. I'm 100% behind the move, but I'm looking to both sides and my own opinion on both sides, I suppose, and where they stand, and maybe there's that further disconnect.
Guys, I think it's something we're going to be talking about for a long time to come.
A weekly slot.
Yeah, it's not going to happen overnight. And I think everyone is aware that it's going to be a process and hopefully a very open and transparent one, and that we'll have lots of discussions and talking points around the different expectations and demands that all the parties are going to have. But the most important thing, I think, is that everybody engages and are very honest about what they need to get from the integration. Because if that honesty isn't there from everyone involved, I think it'll be very difficult to make any progress whatsoever. Nadine, before we finish up, there's a big game this weekend, Dublin and Meath.
There is a big game. A big game, but will it be a big game? That's the question. Look, they're both safely through to the semi-final. Dublin were incredible, I thought, against Cork. And I know it's February, you know, it was a February game, but they were unreal. Meath have been really impressive in their last two outings. Both teams have started with really strong starting lineups. Dublin will want to get revenge. Meath will want to keep up their push for, you know, we weren't a one-hit wonder. So I don't know. I don't know what way it'll go. I don't know what kind of teams they'll line out.
Nobody's going to want to lose,
but the two managers might decide to hold back because they could easily meet in a final. So I'm not going to call it. I don't know. It'll just be hopefully a good game.
Talking about it next week for sure. Okay, Aoife, thank you so much for joining us. Nadine, stay with us because I do want to talk a little bit more about Chelsea after the break, because Roman Abramovich has released a statement and he said that he is planning to sell the club. So stay with us because we'll have more details on that very shortly.
RTE
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Now it is time to turn our attention to the Women's National League. It is getting underway at the weekend, and I am delighted to say that I'm joined now by Steve Feeney, the first ever manager of the Sligo Rovers women's team. Steve, thanks so much for joining us. It must be a very exciting time now that the games are coming.
Very exciting. I suppose we've been building to this the last few months and weeks, and now that we're only days away, like, we're all looking forward to getting down and getting playing games.
So what's the process been like? You're taking over a newly formed team. Is it a case of recruitment, pre-season, planning, just getting everything up and going to working towards this weekend?
Yeah, that's it, I suppose. A lot of work going on behind the scenes, you know, by the club and by myself at the backroom team, and obviously the players as well. Just to kind of put things in place that we can build on going forward, you know. Obviously Saturday is the first game, but we're kind of looking at it with a longer kind of vision of the whole season and that, and making sure that what we've been doing the last few weeks will stand to us as the season progresses.
Yeah, because I'd imagine, just given that you're stepping into a league that is, you know, it's the elite women's football league in the country, and just stepping up to that from not having anything, it must be kind of difficult as well to try and reach that level. It is going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah, it's a big jump. Like, you know, the standard in the National League is very good. You know, there's international players playing with a few of the sides in the league, like, you know. So, but it's like, for us, it's a great challenge. It's a great opportunity for players to go in and play against good teams and good players week in, week out, and test themselves and, you know, show what they can offer to the league and try and, you know, add to the league in that sense.
Yeah, for sure. And no doubt in time as well, attract more players as the club grows and gets stronger and all the rest. And just in terms, we were talking, I don't know if you heard our conversation before the break, about the integration within the GAA and how important it is for the future of women's Gaelic games. How have you found the support from the club?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Yeah, I was listening to the conversation there, right, and I was thinking, oh, lucky I am that there's so much good in place already with the club, with Sligo Rovers, that the CEO and other members of the club have, you know, really got behind us and backed us with that, and we've kind of gone to them about, and you know, they've really rolled in behind to show that this is something that they're serious about. It's not kind of a let's do this to kind of look good or, you know, to tick a box. It's definitely something they want to push on and they want to progress and give the opportunity to women around the area and I suppose further afield in future to come and play for Sligo Rovers in the National League.
We were just talking off air actually about the numbers of girls that are playing sport now and just how it's become such a normal thing, and you see it up in academies all around the country on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning. There's as many girls there as boys, so like you'd have to think as well that you're tapping into a market that is only going to go in one direction, which is memberships, players, interests, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think the women's game is definitely something that's been growing the last few seasons, and I think it's going from strength to strength. And I think as you mentioned, the underage teams and numbers just kind of back that up. You know, there's definitely a higher interest, and I suppose there's a kind of bigger sign of the game taking place, and there's better coverage of the games, and you know, more people talking about it, which is brilliant for girls to aspire to try and play at the National League level, and obviously push on into international standard too.
Steve, how are you? It's David Snide here. Just wanted to ask you, whenever I'm kind of writing about Sligo, the men's team in the League of Ireland, it almost seems obligatory that you have to mention that Sligo is a great soccer town. It's almost like that's what it's like, almost in the contract. But like, I do wonder actually, you know, when you're saying there about building something from scratch, there must be a bit of a freedom and excitement with that, because even when you look at, I'm speaking from the men's perspective, where you look at some of the young lads who've come through, but there's so many, as Marie just touched on there, like the catchment area that's there and just the willingness, I'd say, like just as a coach and as a manager, being able to build something from scratch, that must give you a bit of a thrill.
Yeah, it's very exciting, you know, and I'm delighted that I was given the opportunity, but there's been fantastic work done before I've got involved, you know, with the under-17s and under-19s. There's some, you know, very good players coming through, but there's some very good coaches involved as well. And, like, they're the ones, I suppose, pushing the players on now at that age to try and step up into our team or into our squad. Like, and that's brilliant for us, you know, that we know that there's such good work going on underneath us, that when these players are coming to us, that, you know, they're of a high quality, and, you know, not even just football ability, just, you know, the way they carry themselves, their attitude to things and that, you know. So we're getting kind of players that are, you know, mightn't be exactly ready to step into the National League, but we know we're getting players of a certain standard and people of a certain standard, so that's brilliant. Like,
and even better, as you say as well, like they're going to be used to having demands placing them. Like, they would have been developing obviously through those structures, but now stepping up, you're obviously going to be adding to that a little bit now and just bringing it on to the next level slightly. But as you say, the fact that they've been used to having those demands, be it educationally wise in terms of learning about the game, but now a different kind of element to that.
Yeah, that's it. Like, I suppose it's kind of the next step, or, you know, it might be a few steps, I suppose, coming in. Like, but, you know, they're going to be tested, you know, week in, week out, and against the teams we're going to be playing. Like, so it's important that we're testing them and training and, you know, challenging them and, you know, making them think and act for themselves, because in a game in the National League, you know, they're not going to be able to turn and be told something from the sideline. They're going to have to act in that moment. So it's important that they've been tested at underage, but then obviously when they come up to us as well, that, you know, that test is kind of harder and it's pushing them to think quicker and move quicker, and, you know, because otherwise they're not going to be ready for the National League. Like,
the promotion has been great as well, and I was laughing at one of my friends who's a Sligo Rovers football fan, men's mostly, but he'll be getting on board with the women's when you do start playing. But he was saying every time he logged on to the social media, there was a signing announcement, and it was a woman every time.
But on a serious point, I don't know what's great with Shelbourne as well, is that they have made the decision with all their social media, with everywhere, it's one club, it's that unity, and we're talking about earlier about having that integration, which is what needs to be happening, where it doesn't feel as if it's them and us kind of thing, because like, the last thing you need is to have that. You need to foster that unity and that kind of sense of it is one club.
Yeah, and just getting people used to it and to make it normal, which is the thing. And also, like, when you've set that standard, you have to keep that standard as well, because people will be watching now and there'll be expectation, and, you know, people are very quick to call things out as well when standards start to slip. So we'll be monitoring all that as the season goes on. So we're also joined here on the line as well by Wexford youth player Kylie Murphy. Kylie, how are you?
Hello, how's it going?
Oh, great to chat to you. Are you excited about the season ahead?
Yeah, really looking forward to it.
I love when I talk to Wexford youth players at the start of the season, because it always feels like you nearly get a little bit forgotten about it at the start, because you're kind of focusing on the Dublin clubs and, you know, the likes of Peay, Mount and Shelbourne. But every single season, Kylie, you turn up.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the plan. That's why all the hard work goes in. I suppose we're kind of used to being forgotten about, I suppose, until it comes towards the end of the season. So it doesn't really make much difference now anyway. But yeah, that's the plan at the start of every year, to lift as much silverware as we can and compete with the best underneath.
Yeah, and as I said, you very rarely disappoint. And for yourself, Clydie, as well, look, you know, you keep coming back year after year too. So you must feel something good in the team, that you keep wanting to be part of it and you keep wanting to push them on and being the person as well that drives those standards relentlessly.
Yeah, I'm not the only one. There's an awful lot of people, you know, that do so much good in that club, players and management and volunteers. But I suppose it's just the love of the game and the love of Wexford Utes. It's just, you know, I'm really enjoying my soccer, probably more so in the latter years of my career. I feel like as the years kind of go on, I'm kind of getting fitter and feeling better. So I suppose for the time being, why stop?
Yeah, you're dead right. We were talking to Steve Feeney, and I'm going to say goodbye to Steve now because I do want to talk a little bit about just the addition of Sligo Rovers, Kylie, and how important it is to, you know, to have that team and to have the association with a club like Sligo Rovers as well, and what it means to the women's National League to bring in a team like that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very important that we keep adding that the FAI keep adding teams every year, because obviously you want to build it to be as big as you can, and Sligo are a huge club, so to have them in the Women's National League is only going to increase, I suppose, hopefully supporters, numbers. You know, it's just it's incredible to have them in, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they're about.
Yeah, and as well, on top of that, just like there's obviously yourselves and P-Mount and Shells are up there at the top, and the excitement last year was brilliant. But that chasing pack as well, do you feel like that the gap is going to close a little bit this year?
Yeah, absolutely. If I had to pick some teams, I'd definitely throw in DLR and Galway. They've been making huge strides in the last couple of years, and I mean, you see what Galway done to P-Mount in the last game of the season. Like, they're capable of that, and they're playing like that, you know, throughout the year. So I do think last year is probably the last year where that three are going to be kind of having such a huge point difference. So it's exciting, because we want it to be competitive. You don't want two or three teams running away. You want every team competing.
Yeah, Shauna Cook also joins us on the line. Shauna, just from your point of view, we're just talking about the top three and hoping that the gap closes, because ultimately what everybody wants is a competitive league that when you're heading into it, you're not sure who's going to take the title.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want. I think Kylie's exactly right there. That would be the last season we'll see the top three run away with it. I think Waves will definitely be very hungry this year. I know Graham had kind of plans to get that fourth spot last year, and he'll be wanting to drive on. And as well, as Kylie said there, Galway finished really, really strong. So I think all eyes will be on them as well to push on. So hopefully we'll see more kind of competitive games and less of those 6-7-0 games.
Yeah, it just takes a bit of time, really, Shauna. And what about Shelburne? Just given the fact that there has been a few high-profile departures from the club, and look, it is great to see some of the girls heading over to England to play at that level, but does it give an opportunity now for some of the younger players to step up?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's some young players there that I've watched over pre-season, and I've been really surprised. Young Taylor Wright, who's been on the bench kind of for a lot of last season, has had the opportunity to step up, and really impressed Abby Larkin as well. So that's just the nature of the game. Until the FAI kind of invest and support the clubs and go on semi-pro and pro, that's going to be a massive problem, and we're going to see that drain. But the other aspect of it as well is, you know, I've been working with Shells of late to kind of just tap into the local leagues as well, is to not just rely on that kind of, you know, young, I suppose, player stepping up, because sometimes it can be too big of a step, you know, and forcing a 15 or 16 year old into a senior setup because you've lost players, you know, isn't necessarily always the right thing to do. So just being able to go out and look at the local leagues, and you know, they recently signed Gemma Quinn, who's making massive strides with Celeste Donny Carney in the local league.
Yeah, just having that pathway, I guess, and you know, making people and players realise that that they can go in and join these clubs and that it's actually attainable, and if they're playing at a certain level that they can step up. Kylie, Shauna mentioned the semi-pro word there. From your point of view, I'd say it's something that you'd love, but can you see it happening in your time?
Oh God, not in my time, no.
so not the next 15 years is what you're saying.
It's something that I would genuinely love to see. I mean, you take the likes of Shells after losing so many incredible players. It's not only for Shells but for the league. You know, it's going to drop the standard, which obviously we don't want. You know, so if that could happen in the next couple of years, it would be incredible. And like Shauna said, the support to come in and the funding, because we really just have some incredible players in Ireland, and you know, to showcase them week in week out in Ireland would be just fantastic, rather than losing them to other leagues.
Yeah, I have to agree. Kylie and Sean, I think that's the perfect note to leave it on, and hopefully we will get there sooner rather than later. And Kylie, best of luck to you now when you do get going. Looking forward to seeing how this season goes. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we finish up, we are going to very quickly talk about the statement that Roman Abramovich, the owner of Chelsea, has put out. So it's on the Premier League's website, and he has said that he has made the incredibly difficult decision to sell the club. He had given stewardship and care to the Chelsea Foundation's trustees after Russia invaded Ukraine, and it had been speculated that he was going to sell, and now that a decision has been made, he said that he always takes the decisions with the club's best interests at heart, and in the current situation he's decided he is going to sell, as this is in the best interest of the clubs, the fans, the employees, as well as the club sponsors and partners. He said the sale of the club will not be fast tracked, will follow due process, and he will not be asking for any loans to be repaid. David, he's saying it's in the best interest of a lot of people there, but I'd imagine it's in the best interest of himself as well.
You would imagine so. Now, if you're taking this on face value, the stuff that seems extraordinary and very pertinent is the fact that he says it won't be fast tracked. So that would suggest that obviously it's not about trying to race against time if possible sanctions are coming, but obviously the beauty of reasons, it feels like someone self-preservation a little bit, but which I find incredible and makes you kind of almost say, well, maybe this fella has a small bit of a heart. He actually uses the words of the war in Ukraine, which is incredible because it's something that he's totally ignored. So in all the previous statements that Chelsea have released, it hasn't been mentioned. And he's also said that he's instructing his team to set up a charitable foundation where all net proceeds from the sale will be donated to in the benefit of those victims of the war in Ukraine, and that includes providing critical funds towards the urgent and immediate needs of victims, as well as supporting the long term work of recovery. So personally, just looking at that, seems staggering, and that Abramovich, who has so those links to Putin and what's happening in Russia, is actually acknowledging the fact that it is a war, because that seems to have been totally whitewashed when you look at everything that's happening from the Ukraine. And the fact that he's actually not, he says he's not going to take the 1.5 billion which is what he'd be owed in loans, is quite extraordinary.
Okay, well, we will have to go and talk about that tomorrow because we are out of time. Nadine and David, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow and no doubt be chatting a little bit more about Chelsea and Roman Abramovich. Tara Kumar is up next.